From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In 1958, J.L. Chestnut was the first and only black lawyer in Selma, Alabama. When Selma became a focal point of the civil rights movement, he had to choose between the movement's civil disobedience tactics and an attorney's respect for the law. On this edition of Fresh Air, J.L. Chestnut on being black in Selma. Also today, we meet composer and lyricist Richard Adler. He co-wrote the songs for the hit musicals Damn Yankees and The Pajama Game. Rock critic Ken Tucker tells us if some of the current movie soundtrack albums are as good or bad as the movies that spawned them. And film critic Stephen Schiff tells us if Jack Nicholson's new movie, The Two Jakes, is as good as its predecessor, Chinatown. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. The United Nations Security Council today branded Iraq's annexation of Kuwait null and void and called on all nations to reject the puppet Kuwaiti regime. The vote was unanimous. The resolution demanded immediate and unconditional Iraqi troop withdrawal from Kuwait. An emergency Arab summit, which was scheduled to begin tonight, has been postponed until tomorrow. Analysts say the delay shows there are still deep divisions among the Arab states. Linda Gradstein reports from Cairo.
Luxury jets landed in Cairo Airport all day today as Arab leaders flocked to the Emergency Arab Summit in Cairo. As each leader came off the plane, an Egyptian band played the country's national anthem. When Kuwait's turn came, the Kuwaiti Emir Sheikh Sabah started to cry. It also showed that Egypt, like most of the Arab League, does not recognize the Iraqi annexation of Kuwait. At the last minute, the emergency summit, which is seen as a last-ditch Arab effort to resolve the Gulf crisis peacefully, was postponed until tomorrow. The official reason was that four Arab countries had not arrived yet. But analysts said the real reason was that there is no agreement on who will represent Kuwait, the Emir or Iraq. Saddam Hussein himself did not come, but sent a deputy prime minister and his foreign minister, Tariq Aziz. Analysts said there is little chance that Saddam will agree to withdraw from Kuwait. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Cairo.
The Saudi Arabian king has informed his people for the first time that American troops have landed on Saudi soil. The message broadcast on Saudi television characterized the Iraqi invasion as the most serious aggression in Arab history. NPR's Deborah Amos has more from Dubai.
Reading the Saudi Arabian newspapers or listening to its broadcasts in the past few days, Saudi citizens could find very little news of the Iraqi invasion and only a notice that the U.S. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney came for talks. Today, the Saudi king broke the official silence and told his subjects that the American troops had arrived. He said that the troops were not directed against anyone and would leave the country as soon as possible. Jordan, Iraq's strongest ally, announced today it would honor the U.N. embargo. In addition, the Jordanians will not recognize Iraq's annexation of Kuwait. In Dubai, this is Deborah Amos.
Thousands of foreigners are trapped in Iraq and occupied Kuwait today because of Baghdad's refusal to let them leave. The State Department says Iraq has now made clear that the vast majority of foreigners within its borders would not be allowed to leave, including 38 Americans held under armed guard at a Baghdad hotel. The White House said today President Bush will order military personnel exempted as necessary from across-the-board cuts that would be triggered by the failure of budget negotiations between the administration and Congress. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 24 points to close at 2758.91. Advances led declines. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Selma, Alabama holds an important place in the civil rights movement. In March 1965, on a day now remembered as Bloody Sunday, men and women marching from Selma for voting rights were attacked by state troopers and white posses. The Voting Rights Act was passed in part in response to this tragedy. At the time, my guest J.L. Chestnut was a lawyer in Selma working with the NAACP. In 1958, Chestnut had become Selma's first and only black lawyer. He defended activists during the civil rights movement, and since then he's been involved in what he describes as the longer march, turning the victories of the civil rights movement into grassroots change. He founded a law firm in Selma that is now the largest black law firm in Alabama. Chestnut has written an autobiography, Black in Selma. It's co-authored with Julia Cass, a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. In his book, Chestnut writes about growing up in Selma in the years before the Civil Rights Act. to help him get ahead in the world, his mother had him use a cream to lighten his skin.
I never agreed with that. I went along. My mother's a very strong woman, and she felt that black people could not help anybody. They needed all the help they could get in Selma, in the South, when I was growing up in the 40s. And so she cultivated white people, and she noticed and told me that if you look about you, all of the prominent black people are light-skinned. The postman, the doctor, the better-known preachers, those who pass at the larger churches. And so she would use this skin lightening as to help her only child get ahead. That is the way she saw things. I never really believed in it, but she's such a strong woman, you go along with her.
What was in the cream, by the way, do you know?
I don't know, but it worked because I'm brown and I turned kind of reddish to her absolute delight.
So it really changed the color of your skin?
It really did.
Huh. Do you regret that?
Well, I think it makes you think about a nation that would cause people to develop so much self-hatred that you could really have a product on the market commercially successful to try and change one's appearance. And then I'm really sad that my mother would have to stoop to that to try to, in her view, to get her son ahead in the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Mm-hmm. You went to law school at Howard University, and then you returned to Selma, Alabama. Why did you go back home?
Well, Martin Luther King Jr., who's 1 year older than I am, had, with Rosa Parks, started virtually a revolution in Montgomery, which is just 50 miles east of Selma. And other things were developing in Selma and in the South, which indicated to me that the action likely to come would come in the South rather than in Harlem or in the North. Now, I did not anticipate any action on the scale as the Civil Rights Movement. We had some very modest goals in mind. If you remember the Montgomery bus boycott, Martin and the group were not asking for integrated buses. They were just asking for the right to sit from the back up halfway and have whites sit from the front halfway. They were not even seeking integration of the buses because that was almost fantasy land back there. So I didn't anticipate anything like what did happen.
My guest is J.L. Chestnut, and he has written an autobiography called Black in Selma, Politics and Power in a Small American Town. When you returned to Selma as a lawyer, what kind of cases did you get, being the first black lawyer in Selma?
Yeah, let me give you some flavor of what was going on there. There were only 150 blacks registered to vote out of a pool of about 15,000. Not one black, not one in the entire state of Alabama had ever served on a jury. No blacks had jobs downtown except as delivery people or janitors. And a black person could literally lose his or her life for not yielding a sidewalk or saying sir or ma'am to a white person. Fear was everywhere. It engulfed Selma and it engulfed the South. Now, that is the Selma, the South that I went back to practice law. And the white lawyers there were not only the rulers of the town, they were sophisticated, the country club sophisticates and all of that. They didn't associate with ordinary white people. And he certainly didn't want any parts of some black coming in talking about he was a lawyer in the Dallas County Bar Association. Selma is the county seat of Dallas. Promptly passed a resolution and took it to each bank and asking the banks not to lend me any money so that I could open an office. And I had no intentions of trying to borrow any money in any event because I didn't have any collateral. But everybody was hostile. The judge, the officers of the court, the jury, because these seemed to be the same white males all serving in every case. And I had to ask myself many, many times whether or not my client really would be better off with a white lawyer, one who didn't know anything, didn't know as much as I did.
You make an interesting point in your book. You say that We know when you started as a lawyer, there was no Voting Rights Act, there was no Civil Rights Act. So a lot of injustices couldn't be taken to court.
What we hoped to do was to make new law. We didn't expect to win at that level. The NAACP at that point were financing a lot of criminal cases which were pregnant with the possibility of establishing some of the laws we have on the books now, the Miranda thing where the police have to read you your rights and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the South was fertile territory for that because just being black in the South made one vulnerable to the police and all of their excesses, and many of them were untrained and in their relationships with black, unrestrained. So we were trying to get cases to the United States Supreme Court that would deal with the whether a confession was voluntary. Eventually we did and changed the law on that subject. A lot of things which are now the law came about through some of our efforts, and the court, just with the passage of time, got where we were trying to push them way back in, 1958, 1960.
You said that you didn't feel completely part of the black world as a lawyer in Selma, and that you felt alienated from the gossip and endless conversations about sex and women, and that nobody really wanted to organize or take action.
Well, that's right, but you have to remember, in the Selma of that day, it could easily cost you your life. Many people were killed for talking politics or talking about changing the social order. When I went back to Selma, I didn't expect to become a part of the white world. I had no intentions or desire to become a part of that world. What I didn't anticipate is that I wouldn't be quite a part of the black world either. Now, these were my friends. I went to school with them. I was born there in Selma. And they loved to kid around with me, but it was a kind of superficial. It was something phony about it because everybody was scared to death that I would bring up something about voting or about the law. And black people had to be very careful because you never knew what black would go back downtown and tell white people of power that this black said that or said that. And so people were very nervous around me. And a lot of times I'd come in a place and all conversation would stop or some people would get up and leave. And there I was, isolated, alone, in a little town of 20,000, 28,000 people, the town in which I was born.
Were people worried also that because you were a lawyer and a representative of the law that you not turn someone in exactly, but that maybe you'd inform on someone or report on someone? Was there that fear, too?
No, it wasn't that. My reputation in Selma was clear that I had been fighting the police almost literally since I was 7 years old. They knew there was no way I would turn anybody into the police. I might turn the police into somebody.
What was your reaction as a, quote, local when Martin Luther King came to organize in Selma in 1965?
Well, I had been somewhat ambivalent about all of the civil rights leaders. I felt that what they were saying was directed more at the masses than at me. After all, I had 2 degrees, too, and I was educated. And Martin had views which ran counter to everything I'd learned in law school. For an example, he insisted that he had a high moral right to disobey an unjust law. And he would make the determination when the law was unjust. That is not what I learned in law school. That wasn't what I believed in. I felt that you go to court to get a law declared unconstitutional. I wasn't quite sure about all this unjust business. That's not the terminology that lawyers use. In addition to that, Martin was always trying to get me to give up my weapon and calling me a man of little faith. And I was telling him that you go ahead and preach to the masses, but I'm not paying you any attention. I'm going to keep my weapon because it can bark here and bite way down the street. And Martin would laugh. But I knew that his presence in Selma meant that more people like my mother, middle-class blacks, would become involved. that Martin's presence gave a legitimacy to the movement that it otherwise would not have. Also, as long as he was involved, important and powerful white people in Washington would be watching. So he meant everything to the movement.
Did you ever get more comfortable with civil disobedience as a tactic for civil rights?
I was finally convinced that Martin was correct and the people who were paying me were incorrect. It is not generally known, but you take Bloody Sunday. That started out of a situation where a young man, Jimmie Lee Jackson, was shot dead by a state trooper. People were so frustrated and all that, they came up with the grotesque idea of just taking Jimmie's body and marching 50 miles to Montgomery and putting the body on George Wallace's desk. And, of course, that was not done, but it was agreed to make the march to Montgomery. And Martin was not involved in that first march, but he came on, I think, the day following in that march. But what is not generally known is while they were putting the people in the streets, they were not paying for that. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund in New York was financing that. And they were a legalistic organization. That's who I work for. Their view was that you take two or three obviously qualified people, send them down to get registered, and when they are turned down, you go into court, you got a perfect case. Martin was repudiating all that by sending 500 people down because he said he wanted to win in the court of public opinion. He was not interested just in adding a few more votes to the voting rolls in Selma. So I eventually came around to the point of view that he was correct and my bosses were not.
Well, Bloody Sunday on March 7th, 1965, happened during a march from Selma to Montgomery to petition George Wallace for the right to vote. The march was broken up violently by state troopers. Would you share some of your memories of that day?
Well, I had come over from Mississippi, and I wasn't sure that there would be a march. Martin was in Atlanta preaching at his father's church, and some people in Martin's organization did not think well of a march. They didn't think it was worth risking Martin. But I think Andy Young called him in Atlanta and persuaded him that there would be a march with or without him. And Martin then okayed the march. I had gone across the river earlier, across the bridge, because they would not let lawyers march. You know, you had enough foot soldiers. What we didn't have was enough lawyers. And it didn't make sense to have lawyers in jail. So I had gone across the river earlier, not knowing whether there would be a march, and to get to a telephone, because once a march started, you would have the FBI, the press, and everybody fighting over the one telephone. So I went over there early to tie it up in case there would be a march. And I'd have to describe to the NAACP what was happening because they were paying the bill. And I was over there tying up the telephone, and I looked up toward the bridge, and there was John Lewis, who's now Congressman John Lewis from Georgia, Atlanta. And this group of marchers coming toward this great line of state troopers and possemen. And I began to describe the scene over the telephone to New York. And then John and the group came face to face with the troopers. And I heard some voice, a state trooper, who said that, stop, this will be as far as you will be permitted to go. Turn around and go back to your churches. And then John and the others began to kneel and pray. And then I heard something that sounded like a tear gas canister hit the pavement. And then there was smoke, bedlam, confusion, blood, tears, cries, and there were these big, hefty possemen swinging billy clubs the size of baseball bats and coming down across the heads of women and children. My eyes were hurting, my head was hurting, and New York was screaming over the telephone, what's going on, what's going on? And I tried to pull some women back out of the street, and it was just awful. It was one of the lowest days of my life. At that day, I lost all faith in America. I lost all faith in white people. I said, my God, black people will never be citizens. We will never be what we ought to be in this land. And what is this? I have gone to Howard University. I'm a lawyer, an officer in the white man's court. And here these people are trampling on my folk in the streets, blood everywhere. And they're trampling on the Constitution, and nobody does anything about it because these people are black. And I was just almost in tears. And 2 days later, I had to revise and make a new assessment because white people and black people came from all over this nation that watched it on television, and they were thoroughly upset at what they saw. You know, it's easy to send a check down from New York and say, I'm with you. It's something altogether different to come down and lock hands with a black person and say, I'm ready to go to jail. I'm ready to die if necessary. And I saw hundreds and hundreds of people come from all over this land to join with us in this little town of my birth. And I had to look and reassess all over again. My faith in this nation, my faith in the human race was restored.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is J.L. Chestnut, and in 1958, he became the first black lawyer in Selma, Alabama. He later founded his own law firm, which is now the largest black law firm in Alabama. His new autobiography is Black in Selma, Politics and Power in a Small American Town. This is Fresh Air. Joining us, my guest is J.L. Chestnut, and in 1958, he became the first black lawyer in Selma, Alabama. He's written an autobiography called Black in Selma, Politics and Power in a Small American Town. When the Voting Rights Act was actually passed, what were the immediate effects in Selma?
The immediate effect was that in a six-week span, we went from about 200 registered voters to 9,000. I don't know whether there has been a leap of such proportions in the history of the human race. People who could not vote had no voice in their government in a matter of 6 weeks, became very important players. It is somewhat reminiscent of what has just transpired in Eastern Europe. But we saw immediate impact of that in the courtroom. Blacks began to show up on juries. White politicians had to temper what they said about blacks. And some blacks began to feel that they could run for office. Where there had been hopelessness, we now had hope. Where we felt, I certainly felt, that all we could really hope for was to make some adjustments around the edges in the economic sphere, or maybe get enough votes to get the white policeman out of black summer. I saw now that we could do much more than that, that blacks could really sit on governments and pass laws that affected both black and white people. America began to develop some meaning for me.
What are some of the difficulties of, in a way, being part of the establishment now rather than being outside of it?
It is far more difficult to advise a school board than it is to attack it. It's easy to attack it. But when you got to raise the money, and when you have to find the teachers, and you have to comply with the state law, all of that's infinitely more difficult to do than just standing and being a gadfly and a critic on the outside. And all of a sudden, after the Voting Rights Act, and blacks were voting, and see, I come from what is called a black belt in Alabama. This is where the large slave plantations were. That's why most of these counties are 60% and 70% black, and they are as racially polarized as any in South Africa. because whites knew that once blacks got the votes, blacks would take them over. And blacks have taken over county governments, county school boards. And because we were there fighting with them, they retained our law firm. And we had to go from outside protesters to inside establishment people. And it hasn't been easy.
I'd like to get back now to something you said earlier when we were talking about Martin Luther King. You said that one of the things he wanted you to do was to give up your weapon.
Yes.
And that you were unwilling to do that. It was a gun.
That's right.
You write that you actually gave up your gun the night Martin Luther King was assassinated.
I did. I threw it in the river.
Oh, why?
Well, that was my deep feeling over Martin. I stayed down there on that river under the same bridge, the Edmund Pettus Bridge, crying for about 30 minutes and reflected on it, that my carrying a weapon certainly had not saved Martin. It didn't save Jimmie Lee Jackson. I couldn't think of anything it had done for me, really. And I'd seen John Lewis stare down a whole regiment of state troopers and sheriffs, and he had no weapon. And the things that had been brought about, the changes that had occurred in Selma in the South, had not come at the end of any gun. So it's a tribute to my friend who'd given his life in Memphis. I threw it away and watched it sink in the river, and I felt better.
Had you ever used it? What did you want it to do for you when you had the gun?
Oh, just for self-protection. I was not going to attack anybody, but if they came to get me, I would be ready. You know, Martin Luther King was preoccupied with death, foreboding all the time. And he said more than once that they're going to come for us, each one of us, and we won't be back. And I believed him. But the only difference is I had a weapon and I had intended to take some with me.
Now that your memoir is completed, your autobiography, and you can see your life compressed between the covers of a book, has it led you to think about anything that you haven't thought about before or see your life in a different context than you'd seen it before?
Well, when you are battling and going from one war to the next, so to speak, you really don't have any sense of the whole. And this book has caused me to see the many, many barriers that have fallen in the last 30 years that I had never really given any thought to. I am really astounded at the progress we have made, but I'm even more astounded at the progress we haven't made. It's like talking to white people in Selma who are always telling me, said, look how far you've come in no time at all. And I'm always saying, that's true, but look how far we have to go. I guess it's the old argument about whether the glass is half full or half empty with water. And it depends on your vantage point. But I've had a chance to view for the first time because of this book. I've had a chance to look back over 30 years. And I'm not displeased with what I see.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
My guest has been J.L. Chestnut. His new autobiography is Black in Selma, Politics and Power in a Small American Town. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Hey There, Hernando's Hideaway, Steam Heat, You Gotta Have Heart. Four hit songs from two hit Broadway shows. Coming up, Richard Adler on co-writing the songs for Pajama Game and Damn Yankees, and on life after those two early successes. Also, Ken Tucker reviews Ford Fairlane, Dick Tracy, and Days of Thunder, not the movies, the soundtrack albums from the movies. And film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of The Two Jakes. It's the sequel to Roman Polanski's 1974 film Chinatown. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, the UN Security Council has declared Iraq's annexation of Kuwait is null and void. The council vote was 15-0, as the Soviet delegate told the council his government is opposed to the use of force and unilateral decisions and favors UN solutions to resolve such conflicts. Jordan, so far one of Iraq's staunchest allies, says that it will now comply with UN sanctions, even if it means closing access to an essential port. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports from Amman.
The port of Aqaba in South Jordan on the Red Sea links to Iraq by an overland route. It's now one of Iraq's last strategic ports since Turkey closed its oil pipeline and since oil has been diminished in the Saudi Arabian pipeline. King Hussein of Jordan, seeking to distance himself now from Iraq if there is war in the Gulf, said last night that he recognizes his UN responsibilities and will comply with the UN sanctions. Today, one of his ministers told journalists that meant Aqaba must close. Meanwhile, Jordan has put its troops and security police on alert. For 2 minutes this morning, Jordan tested its air raid sirens. Preparation, it said, in the event of any attack. It's not clear whom that attack might be from, but Jordan provides an overland route to Israel, a possible Iraqi target. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman.
The French government has announced that if the current Arab effort to bring an end to the Gulf crisis fails, it will send additional air and naval forces to Saudi Arabia. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from London.
The French government has been severely embarrassed by Iraq's invasion of Kuwait because Baghdad has used French arms to carry it out. For years, France has been Iraq's second largest supplier of sophisticated weaponry, including missile technology. But at a news conference after an emergency cabinet meeting, French President François Mitterrand said his government would strengthen its air and naval forces in the Persian Gulf if Arab efforts to bring about the withdrawal of Iraqi forces fail. Currently, there is a small French naval force in the Gulf. Mitterrand said he would send military and technical aid to Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states if requested. In that case, France would join Great Britain in supporting materially the U.S. deployment. The foreign ministers of NATO meet tomorrow in Brussels, where the U.S. is expected to ask for even wider European support. This is Mike Schuster in London.
Arab leaders meeting in Cairo have postponed their summit until tomorrow. President Hussein of Iraq, who set the crisis in motion, is not attending the Cairo meeting. The King of Saudi Arabia has made his first public comment on the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, calling it the most horrible aggression in the modern history of the Arab world. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 24 points today to close at 2,758.91 on volume of some 156 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, I'll talk with composer and lyricist Richard Adler, one half of the team that wrote the songs for Damn Yankees and The Pajama Game. But first, music from movies. Ever since the soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever sold more than 9 million copies, the record industry has placed a high premium on movie soundtrack albums. The Fever album also was the first to include many different artists performing new songs. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of three current soundtrack albums, a couple of which, he says, may even do better than their movies.
In recent years, it's been proven that even awful movies can yield successful soundtrack albums. Remember Cocktail, the dog that starred Tom Cruise as a bartender? Its soundtrack included the Beach Boys' Kokomo. The song made it to number one. The album sold over 2 million copies. Tom Cruise's new movie, Days of Thunder, has an extremely eclectic soundtrack album. 11 artists, including Elton John, Guns N' Roses, Chicago, and Cher, pop up here. The Elton John song, however, called You Gotta Love Someone, is one of his more skillful recent performances. It harks back to the mid-70s, when he really knew how to create a catchy pop record.
You can win the fight, you can grab a piece of the sky.
like the rose, but before you try, you gotta love someone. You gotta love someone.
Another soundtrack album for the recently released Adventures of Ford Fairlane is, of course, a collector's item for the singing debut of its star, Andrew Dice Clay.
I got a 65 Cadillac, bad tire on my back, charge called to go black, but I ain't got you. Got women to the right of me, got women to the left of me, I got chicks all around me, but I ain't got you. Got the tab at the liquor store, I hit the number 444, I got a mojo, but don't you know, I'm all dressed up and no place to go. I got women to the left of me, I got women to the right of me, I got chicks all around me, but I ain't got you, but I ain't got you.
Believe me, all the fuss people are making over this guy about how offensive he is, the Dice Man is no enduring threat to American culture. He tells jokes about as well as he sings, and the movie has already faded at the box office. I'm betting his career is just about out of here. The Ford Fairlane soundtrack is mostly overloaded with hard rock banality by the likes of Motley Crue, Billy Idol, and Richie Sambora, whose version of Jimi Hendrix's The Wind Cries Mary suggests that he'd be better off just being known as Cher's boyfriend. But what I regret is that no one seems to notice the one real treasure on this album, Glad to Be Alive, a touching duet by Teddy Pendergrass and Lisa Fisher.
So you're feeling bad. Got no one around. Oh no, wish you had that someone
to make you feel.
Every day I'm glad to be alive.
Warren Beatty's Dick Tracy movie has yielded no fewer than three new albums. There's Madonna's I'm Breathless, reviewed here a while back. There's Danny Elfman's instrumental music, which does little more than rip off his own Batman score. And there's also an album called Just Dick Tracy, produced by Andy Paley. It's the one getting the least attention, and it's also the most interesting. If you're trying to figure out Andy Paley's contribution to the film's soundtrack, well, he did everything that's not Madonna and not an ominous instrumental. He produced, for example, the Jerry Lee Lewis track that's heard very briefly in one quick scene in the movie.
I didn't mean to make a scene, it's really not my style. I raised some cane and called some names, I guess I got myself a little wild. If I brag too loud and act too proud, don't blame old Jerry Lee. It was the whiskey talking, not me. I had myself a little splash. I said, you no good piece of trash. Shot my mouth all through the night. But Lord, my bark's bigger than my bite. If lies were told, if I was bold, don't take it personally. It was the whiskey talking, not me. Listen.
Now, Jerry Lee Lewis fans will instantly realize that that's the best the old killer has sounded in years, and we have Andy Paley to thank for that. There's other stuff on this collection that I certainly don't remember from the movie, but is worth hearing, such as this odd team-up of K.D. Lang and the gospel group Take Six.
Oh, the country's long and wide.
The Santa Fe's my bride.
I'll hop her when she sails.
That's why I'm riding the rail.
I'm riding, I'm sliding, I won't last too long. Got a bandana and a whistle for a song. There ain't no wheels on the floor of a
Again, to my ears, Andy Paley has redeemed a singer. That performance by Katie Lang removes many of the coy mannerisms of Lang's country material. With similarly good performances by artists ranging from August Darnell to Darlene Love, it would be a shame if Andy Paley's Dick Tracy work got lost in the media shuffle.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. This is Fresh Air. In 1955, the New York Times called Richard Adler and Jerry Ross Broadway's hottest young composers. They wrote the music and lyrics for The Pajama Game and quickly followed that with Damn Yankees. Both shows were directed by George Abbott. But everything changed for Adler when his songwriting partner Jerry Ross died in 1955 at the age of 29. Adler writes about his early success and his life after Ross and Broadway in his new memoir, You Gotta Have Heart. The title comes from a song Adler and Ross wrote for Damn Yankees. They also wrote such popular songs as Hey There, Hernando's Hideaway, and Steam Heat.
Yeah! I got steam heat, I got steam heat, I got steam heat, but I need your love to keep away the cold, I got.
Back in the days that you wrote Pajama Game and Damn Yankees, 54, 55, was everything offered to Rodgers and Hammerstein first?
Everything was offered to everybody first before us. We were totally unknown, inexperienced, and when we were handed the Pajama Game by George Abbott, which was called 7½ Cents, the book, and we read the book, I really liked the book very much, and we got a break on that.
When you wrote a song for The Pajama Game, who would you have to play the song for before it got okayed?
George Abbott. Period.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of critiques would he give you?
Critiques? None. He would say yes or no. For the dictaphone song, he wanted a song in a that could be dictated into a dictaphone machine. They didn't have tapes in those days. They had dictaphone machines. So we wrote a terrible song called Dear Babe. And he thought it was terrible. We thought it was terrible, too. He said, give me something a little bit more unique. And then we wrote Hey There. And he liked that a lot and went into the show. Then when it was in the show, being a young, idiotic, and compulsive man, I suddenly thought, gee, this song, it's very lovely, but it maybe isn't commercial enough. And I wrote 6 songs trying to write around Hey There to get it out of the show. And Abbott kept saying, don't bother me, I like Hey There, each time. He would listen, and he, thank God, didn't succumb to my persuasiveness.
Hey there, you with the stars in your eyes. Love never made a fool of you. You used to be too wise. Hey there, you on that high flying cloud. Though she won't throw a crumb to you, you think someday she'll come to you. Better forget her.
Hey There was actually the big hit from the show. Rosemary Clooney recorded it, and she had a top 10 hit with it.
Top 10. She had the biggest, maybe the biggest record she's ever had. It went 3 million. It was number one for over 7 months, on and off with Hernando's Hideaway. I mean, they would switch from 1 and 2. And at the time, I don't mean to sound braggadocious, but nobody had ever had number 1 and 2 in the hit parade before, not Rodgers or Hammerstein or anybody else. And since then, nobody has either.
You work collaboratively with Jerry Ross, and you both wrote words and music, right?
Right.
What were the mechanics of the relationship?
Well, there were no mechanics to the relationship. We wrote every which way imaginable. Sometimes I would come in with a lyric or a melody, and he would elaborate on it. Sometimes he would, like for instance with Steam Heat. I went to the bathroom one day, and when I got in there, I decided, as I said before, I was a compulsive young man. I decided I'm not leaving this room until I've written a song about something in the room. So there were certain things you can't write about in a bathroom. Then all of a sudden the radiator started clanging and hissing, and I got the idea for Steam Heat. I wrote out a full chorus of it, got out of the bathroom, called Jerry, sang it to him over the phone. We got together the next day and elaborated on it. That's one way that we wrote.
After the success of Pajama Game, you very quickly got involved in writing the words and music for Damn Yankees. How did Damn Yankees happen so quickly on the heels of Pajama Game?
Well, Pajama Game was a big hit, and Mr. Abbott wanted to get the same team together and write another show, and he, the boys, that is Hal Prince and Bobby Griffith, came up with a book called The Year the Yankees Lost the Pennant. Now, we knew that baseball was singularly unsuccessful in the theater, motion pictures, etc. There had never been a hit. It was a taboo. But we tackled it anyway. We all liked the property. And we wrote Damn Yankees, following on the heels of Pajama Game.
Was it easier to write a Broadway show the second time around?
No, much harder.
Why was it harder?
First of all, we had written with much greater abandon when we wrote Pajama Game, because we didn't know what to be afraid of, like the critics. Though the critics were all marvelous to us in Pajama Game, we began to fear that they might not be in Damn Yankees, so we got a little bit apprehensive about that.
One of the best-known songs from Damn Yankees is You've Gotta Have Heart.
You've Gotta Have Heart is the best-known song I think probably I've ever written. And it became really a tremendous hit in the show. It stopped the show from the first performance on.
Now listen to me, you guys. This game of baseball is only one half skill. The other half is something else, something bigger. You gotta have heart. All you really need is heart. When the odds are saying you'll never win, that's when the grin should start. You gotta have hope.
Your songwriting partner, Jerry Ross, died after Damn Yankees at the age of 29. You were devastated by that.
I certainly was. I was devastated, and that was 35 years ago, and I'm still devastated by it. He was like my brother. He was my beloved friend, my younger brother, my collaborator. He was everything to me at the time.
Cole Porter gave you the advice of, just write by yourself now. Your partner's gone. Write by yourself. Why was it so difficult for you to write by yourself?
Well, if you're married and you lose your spouse, it's difficult to adjust to single life. If you're writing as a team successfully, very successfully, after a lot of hard work, and suddenly half of the team is never more. It's difficult. It's hard to adjust. It's hard to explain. So I took Mr. Porter's advice, and it took many years of struggle before I was able to succeed once again. I really literally had to start all over.
What did the new success come with?
Well, it came with songs like Everybody Loves a Lover, which came about 2.5 years later. It came with the writing of probably the most successful jingles at the prices I got to be charging. I call them advertising musicals. It came later on with the writing of, with the commissioning of classical pieces like Wilderness Suite, the Statue of Liberty Centennial piece, The Lady Remembers, the Sesquicentennial of Chicago piece, and other things like that.
Let me ask you about the cigarette jingles, because I think everyone who was alive when you wrote them will know them. So do you want to recite, for instance, the Newport and the Kent?
I can sing it for you.
Oh, great. Okay.
I won't sing the Kent because I don't think I remember it. But Newport filter cigarettes, Newport filter cigarettes, a hint of mint makes the difference, etc. Now, at the time that I wrote that, that was in the very early 60s. I think it was 1960 or 61. I didn't know, as very few people knew 30 years ago, that tobacco was so dangerous to both your heart and your lungs, and that it was a contributory factor to those who had lung cancer, throat cancer, etc. I had no idea that. I just wrote these things because it was good money, and it was fun to do. And at the time, I smoked. And ironically, and maybe not so ironically, 2 years ago, I was cured from throat cancer, which my doctors say I got from having smoked 25 years before. That's how slowly the cancer cells can develop.
Are you still writing music?
Very much so. I have a new show about to be sprung on the public.
Oh, really? A Broadway show?
Well,
we'll see.
We hope so. It's at the stage now where it's being ready to be produced.
I wish you the best of luck with it.
Well, thank you. I can use it. We all can use it.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for allowing me to.
Composer and lyricist Richard Adler. His memoir is called You Gotta Have Heart.
I know a dark, secluded place, a place where no one knows your face. A glass of wine, a fast embrace. It's called Hernando's Hideaway. Ole. All you see are silhouettes.
This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, the American troops have landed in Saudi Arabia. What do you have from there?
Apparently, the world is reacting to the fact that the Americans are in Saudi Arabia. The Arab summit, which was called for today, has been postponed. In Jordan and Libya, young men are volunteering for a force which would join the Iraqi invaders of Kuwait. The United Nations has condemned the annexation of Kuwait, and the Soviets say they want a multinational force. We do have a few other things on the show, Terry. We're talking about your letters and Mr. and Mrs. Bridge, the movie with Woodward and Newman. Susan Stamberg has a report.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The sequel to the movie Chinatown, The Two Jakes, was ready to start shooting in 1986. Chinatown screenwriter Robert Towne had written the script and was going to direct. Jack Nicholson was reprising his Jake Gittes role, and Chinatown producer Robert Evans would produce and co-star. Things broke down on the first day of production, and it's taken until now to get the movie completed. Nicholson directs and stars, and Harvey Keitel took over Evans' screen role. It opens this weekend. Stephen Schiff has a review.
In the history of the movies, Chinatown must be one of the hardest acts to follow, and I've never missed it more than when I was watching The Two Jakes. Not that the sequel is bad, exactly. It's just nothing. It's turgid, complicated, tasteful, and strangely sedative. It's a crossword puzzle of a movie. You watch the clues, you fill in the blanks, and when you're done, you never have to think about it again. The setting is, of course, Los Angeles, only it's 1949 now. 10 years after Jack Nicholson's Jake Gittes watched a cop shoot his beloved Evelyn Mulray amid the Nowheresville of Chinatown. Being a private detective specializing in divorce, Jake has prospered. He plays a mean game of golf these days, and golf seems to be his chief concern. It's a sleazy world he lives in, and Jake knows he's part of the sleaze. Or, as he puts it,
"In this town, I'm the leper with the most fingers."
That's the movie's best line, and you only wish there was more where that came from. But what's left of Robert Towne's cut-up script doesn't have enough zing. Most of the dialogue sounds more like this scene between Jake and Meg Tilly.
"Mrs. Berman, wouldn't you like to know one way or the other?
If there's a relationship, I'd like to know about it, yes?
Then you'll tell me what I want to know.
What's that?
Exactly what Bodine was asking you on the wire.
I'll tell you what I remember. That may not be what you need to know.
The movie's about how Jake is hired by another Jake, Jake Berman, played by Harvey Keitel, to help catch Berman's wife in bed with another man. Everything proceeds smoothly until gunshots are fired. Berman has killed his wife's lover, who is also, it turns out, Berman's business partner. But was it a crime of passion or premeditated murder? The tortuous trail leads Jake Giddies into a world of real estate sharks and budding oil tycoons. But most significantly, it leads him back into the past. One name keeps coming up, Catherine Mulray, the daughter and also the sister, you'll recall, of Faye Dunaway's Evelyn Mulray in the first movie. Jake has pledged to help and protect young Catherine, but he hasn't known where she was since he last saw her that fateful night in Chinatown. Is she even alive? The Two Jakes becomes as much about Giddy's pursuit of Catherine as it is about the Jake Berman case. But the two intertwined quests don't match up very well. Nicholson has directed the movie carefully, but he has trouble making the low comedy bits feel sly, the way Roman Polanski did in Chinatown. And he achieves none of Polanski's ripe aura of suffocating evil. Nor is this one of the great, daring Nicholson performances. He feels reined in here, and so does virtually everyone around him except for Reuben Blades, who tries a jumpy Polanski imitation as a thug, and Madeline Stowe, who flails and wails her way into the Ham Hall of Fame as the dead man's hard-drinking wife. The Two Jakes isn't terrible. It's just a case of enormous potential unfulfilled. Watching it, you ache a little for what might have been, and you miss all the more what was.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air is produced by Fred Lander. All our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, investigative reporter Paul Brodeur on the dangers of electromagnetic radiation from electric blankets, computer terminals, and high-voltage power lines. Also, Jack Barth on America's offbeat roadside attractions. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.